Music sounded a little sick there. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I guess that's fitting. I'm Jim Browder. She's Marjorie Egan.
That's right.
We've all heard of drive-by shootings. What about drive-by shafting? Are you signing your life savings away when you sign that pile of consent forms before you have surgery? And room for rent used to be a familiar sign in poorer parts of town. Now in the poorest reaches of the world, that sign is womb for rent. Is it ethical to pay poor women to bear the children of the rich? And after 30 years of being smoke-free, the great 80-year-old Leonard Cohen reunites with an old flame, the cigarette. Is he the poster elder for bad behavior or a role model for happy living? Joining us on the line to take on these and other ethical questions is Art Kaplan. Art, as you know, is head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hello there, Art.
Hello.
Hey, good morning. Good morning, Art.
Good morning.
Well, Jim called it drive-by shafting in the introduction, but it's really drive-by, I guess it's both, actually, drive-by doctoring. All these people going into the hospital, unsuspecting, getting their surgeries, whatever, and then getting these six-figure bills from all these assistant doctors or other people that showed up. One guy had a bill for $117,000, and it's not that uncommon. What's going on?
This is going to be one of our shorter conversations because what's going on is unethical, crooked, slimy, rotten behavior.
Wow.
By whom? The insurance companies? By the doctors? By the medical infrastructure?
It's,
by whom?
It's in cahoots. So the docs basically say, oh, well, we'll use some outside folks. They'll come by and do procedures. They don't get consent from the patient, and all of a sudden the insurance company says, yeah, we'll pay for that. You charge a very high fee to step in at the last minute and help or even do a procedure. And by the way, I don't know that this happened, but it may be that one of the people involved in that Joan Rivers death was someone who stepped in as a friend and was doing a procedure there too, just to give us an example, concrete example. So all of a sudden, you have somebody who's not on the staff of the hospital, but is friends with other doctors, and they bring them in, and there's sort of this, you refer patients to me, I'll come in and do this for you. There's kind of back scratching going on, and it's all a way to get around fee limits that insurance companies set on particular hospital services by bringing in these drive-by docs. They make money. You get arrangements with them. So I don't want to say they're splitting fees because I don't know that's true, but they're certainly scratching each other's backs with patient referrals. So I think the whole thing just stinks.
So until it is outlawed by state legislatures, by Congress, by whatever, let's talk about what the patient can do. Can the patient say in advance, one, I want to meet or at least know every single person who's got anything to do with my procedure or my care?
Yes.
And two, I want to know what it's going to cost. Should they be asking those things? And
yes,
whether it's, they should?
They should, because some of these fees can wind up with co-pays. You know, your insurance pays, but they say, well, you still are responsible for, I don't know, 10% of the fee. Well, 10% of $100,000, you'd certainly like to know if that's going to suddenly pop up out of nowhere on the bill. So, yeah, I think you want to be asking who's involved with this procedure. You can expect at a teaching hospital that you're going to see some residents and students. That's what academic medical centers do, and I don't have any problem with that. They should just be upfront about it. But if other people are going to be called in or sort of come in on a consulting basis and you're going to get charged additional fees for that, you need to know it. So absolutely raise that question.
You know, one Art, I don't know if I've ever had this discussion with you, and if I haven't, it's amazing because it's something I'm obsessed with. I am a huge believer that we all have to be informed consumers, whether it's a vacuum cleaner or a doctor. However, anybody who denies that it is really hard when you're sitting across from a doctor who doesn't propose the discussion him or herself to start cross-examining the doctor. Tell me who's going to help you. Tell me how much it's going to cost. Tell me this. Tell me that. It is really hard when you're dealing with someone who has skills that you don't really understand. Is that's true, right?
Yeah, it's also someone who's about to stick a knife in your belly.
I know that, of
course.
A
giant tube down your throat, yeah. So you might want to court some favor there. It's not necessarily good to start off cross-examining them. You want to have a good relationship with a doc. So at the end of the day, it isn't informed consent that's going to solve this. It's going to be prosecutions. And I think the insurance company should stop paying this kind of ridiculous fee upcoding and sort of skimming and creaming. I don't think it's going to come from patient demand, so to speak. You are too vulnerable, and it's difficult to do this. I'm saying to ask, but I understand it's really hard.
But one last thing on this. All right, suppose, for example, you come in the emergency room, you're in a car accident, or you have a heart attack or something like that. You're not in a position, obviously, then to be negotiating with the physicians. So if you wind up with these bills afterwards, and someone is listening to this now, I presume that they should refuse to pay and fight them. Okay.
And they should ask the insurance company, you know, not to pay, and they shouldn't pay the co-pays, and they should say, you know, I just got bills here that I don't understand what's going on. Again, unless you're somebody who's been retired about 20 years, going through your medical bill is a full-time occupation that you probably don't have much time with.
Exactly. So, you don't understand them either.
Yeah. So I am looking here for some, you know, attorney general, legal activity. This really is a kind of a scheme that ought to be broken by legal authorities. It's tough to get consumers to stay on top of it.
Well, I'm shocked that these physicians would be trying to pull a fast one here. Are absolutely shocked. Let's move on to something else. I just learned that the mind-altering drug lithium has been in drinking water for at least a half a century, but I shouldn't be worried that this could be a good thing. Please explain, Art Kaplan.
Well, there's lithium in drinking water. There's mercury in the air. There's love in the air. I mean, all of these things are floating around. The environment is full of all kinds of stuff. Some of the lithium that's there is natural because it seeps out of rocks and things. Some of it is there because we put it there as we eliminate some drugs that are in our system and they go into the water supply. But I don't think we're all going to be in a good mood because I think the amounts are still tiny. It's just too small. So, you know, it's kind of funny. People have looked in certain water supplies and seen a lot of cocaine, just like on the dollar bills. And they've seen birth control chemicals and things like that. There may be concentrations that break out once in a while. And certainly you want to make sure that if you're in the engineering end of this thing, you got to be attentive to all this in the water supply. But I don't think we're all going to have a good time because we have a lot of water to drink.
But there are some studies. There was a published report about these Texas counties where the people with the least amount of lithium in the water committed more suicides, more homicides, and more rapes than people who had higher levels who were much more peaceful. So that's pretty dramatic.
It is. And it's also Texas.
What does that mean? I mean, that's my attitude, but why is it yours?
Like they're just shooting and killing each other all day long anyway. So I don't know. I'm being facetious here, not unlike me. But what I'm really saying is, there's probably 100 things that behavior correlates with, but I wouldn't blame it on the water supply.
Well, you know, forget blame for a second. I'd take it to where I think Marjorie was going. You know, you mentioned mercury. No one's going to argue that mercury in your water is a good thing. It is what it is, nor cocaine. The point of this piece in the New York Times about a week or so ago, should we all take a bit of lithium? And that writer is being half-tongue-in-cheek. Mm-hmm. Is there to have the potential of some small benefit from small amounts? And I think the place she almost wanted to go in the piece but didn't have the courage to is the potential benefit of small amounts is such that maybe even municipalities and others should contemplate adding trace amounts to water. Is that beyond the pale?
Well, given the reaction to fluoride, I'll say yeah. I mean, it was a conspiracy of the communists to put these chemicals in the water supply. So
Good point.
I don't know. I don't know that may not be the place to administer it. If you want to take those tiny doses of lithium, you're probably going to have to go to the health food store or buy them on the internet or something like that. But in the public water supply, unless you've got a real public health problem like dental cavities and oral health. Just feeling better or being in a better mood.
No, that's a fine point.
But one last thing about this. There's a professor.
We're not giving up, Art. We want to be clear.
Well, because as Jim says, there's an upside is what this piece is implying. And the headline is, should we all take a bit of lithium? Mm-hmm. There's a professor of psychiatry at Tufts University who is a big proponent of some form of use of lithium because he says it may prevent dementia. And if it does, we may have overlooked a very simple means of preventing a major public health problem. I mean, he's saying maybe we should be taking it.
Well, you know, we have done some things in addition to fluoride. We fortify bread and we put a lot of vitamin C, folic acid, other things into foods because they really do seem to have a disease prevention role. If you could really establish some certainty that lithium, you know, kept us from being depressed or prone to ill health, mental health, yeah, you could have the argument. But again, I suspect for that kind of an intervention, you're going to need a lot more evidence than a suspicion, and there probably are going to be ways to do it without tampering into the water supply.
Yeah.
I mean, foods literally are probably a better way to go because you can buy them or not.
We're talking to Art Kaplan. He is a medical ethicist. He's from NYU. He joins us weekly. Art, you wrote a piece called Paid Surrogacy is Exploitative. Your opening line is, reproductive tourism is enjoying a bit of an economic boomlet. Make the case as to why it's exploitation, and then I think, depending on what you say, I'm going to challenge your thesis.
That's hard to believe, but okay.
Go ahead.
Trade is this. More and more rich people are going from North America, the Middle East, Asian countries to very poor countries, India, Philippines, Ukraine, Belarus, to hire surrogate mothers. And listeners will remember, these are women who get an embryo from the couple. The couple goes there, makes their embryo in a dish, and then it's put into this woman who's hired to carry the baby to term. There are a lot of reasons that surrogates get used. Some women don't have a uterus. Some women are unable to carry a baby in a healthy way. But there are some aesthetic reasons sometimes that people do it. They just don't want to go through the pregnancy. So it can be
complicated. Really? Mm-hmm. Aesthetic mm-hmm. reasons? You mean they're worried mm-hmm. about the state of their belly post-pregnancy or something? Yes, I am shocked.
I'm not
oh,
at all.
No, it has. Somebody says, I don't want those stretch marks. Other people say, I'm in the fashion industry and I don't want to be after pregnancy, blah, blah, blah,
wow.
blah.
No, Giselle Bundchen looks pretty good after two kids, I'll say that.
So I'm not saying you can't. I'm just saying this is what – there's some motives out there. Some are high-minded. Some are perhaps a little bit less so. But in any event, so people say, well, you got poor women, and they're very poor, and they can make some real money here, a couple thousand dollars, which goes a long way in these countries. And they choose to do it, and the people come with the money, and they go home with the baby, and the woman gets the money, and we're all good here. And I don't agree with that. I think it's a little bit more like child labor making your cheap clothing or sneakers, or people working in sweatshops to give us low-priced goods at Walmart or big-box stores. We've tried to stop those practices because exploiting people means they're doing something because they don't have any choice, and they're doing something risky that they don't understand because you have to take a lot of fertility drugs to be able to accept the embryo and so on. And they don't have great health care for very poor people in these countries. So while it might be all right for a middle-class woman in Fitchburg to say, you know, I'm going to hire myself out as a surrogate, and it's something I can choose to do, and I could have other things to do, but I choose this, I think the poorest of the poor basically are told, you can go to the sex trade or you could be a surrogate mother. And those are your choices, and I consider that no choice.
You know, after having heard you, now I'm too embarrassed to come up with, but I'm going to try. Anyway,
You like that sweatshop analogy. Okay, go ahead.
I mean, okay, so I agree with about 95% of what you said. And Marjorie and I talked a lot about these, the iPad and the i-whatever being mm-hmm, made in mm-hmm, these mm-hmm. places in China with these little kids. I mean, little kids can't meaningfully consent to anything. So let's take mm-hmm. them out of the mix. But is there such a thing as meaningful consent in these sort of settings? I mean, one, it is a woman who, as you said, is poverty stricken and needs the money. By the way, it offends the sensibility. Obviously, some rich person is flying over and, mm-hmm. and having some poor person have their kid. But in some ways, it's a twofer. It accomplishes it reaches the result the wealthier person wants. It provides necessary money for the woman in that third world country. And it seems to me that people like you have to construct a formula or a template that allows for there to be meaningful consent. You said a minute ago, Art, they don't have decent medical care. Well, maybe part of the contract, if you can afford to do this, is there's got to be a doctor who is competent, who is available to the woman to make sure that there are as few complications as possible. A lawyer let me finish.
That just added $10,000.
Well, whatever. But I agree. But if you can afford to do this, you got to foot that. There's got to be a lawyer who explains carefully and clearly to this woman. I guess what I'm saying is, you don't think there's any circumstance in which there really can be meaningful consent in those instances, or no?
I don't, because I think to get where you want to go, you're going to raise the price back up to what it is here, and then there's no reason to go there because they're going there to get the cheap goods. Moreover, I don't think you're going to get that in Belarus and Ukraine and the poor villages of India. That's just not going to happen. These people are way below the radar in terms of people worrying about giving them lawyers and giving them, you know, adequate health care and stuff. It ain't going to happen.
So how big a deal? Also, how much is this happening?
Hold on. There is just something fundamentally really creepy.
Yeah, it is creepy. It's horrible.
About bearing a child inside your body. I mean, this is very
personal. But Art doesn't have a problem.
Art
doesn't have a problem if it's from his hometown of Framingham.
Well, if people are volunteering because they feel that, you know, they feel the pain of the woman who's infertile, and that's a different sort of thing. But this, a poor woman far away who's never going to see
this
kid.
What about a poor woman out on the Mass Turnpike who understands, who is here? You think that woman can give meaningful consent, right?
I think some surrogates can. I think they can understand it. They don't have to do it. They could work elsewhere. They can get that lawyer. They can, you know, have somebody represent them and their interests. They can get good medical care and go through it. And I'm not sure it's so awfully risky or so utterly creepy that for a woman who doesn't have a uterus, she might go that route. But what I am saying is I don't want to hear about the ability of a woman living in a cardboard box in a rural Indian village whose husband beats her all the time saying, well,
okay, I give up. You're right.
And there's
one
last thing about this. Why would, if you had that kind of money that you could afford to pay a surrogate, why would you even want to go that route to someone that was in a very poor country and living in a cardboard box?
Because cheaper is what I would
say. I know
says.
It, but you also, the health of the mother as a surrogate really matters.
Right? I know. I do think that really does matter. And, you know, the people who do it, the brokers kind of assure the health of these women, but they're really poor women coming from very tough circumstances.
Exactly.
So I don't know. That's another issue.
Yeah.
But
okay,
for those who still say, well, let them sell, I wind up thinking to myself, okay, well, why are we going through this? Why don't we just let them sell us their baby?
Okay, we're going to erase this part of the tape because I embarrassed myself. So let's move on to my favorite story of the week. And maybe because I'm a huge Leonard Cohen fan, singer-songwriter, but also because it's just a great story about the state of our society. Here's the first paragraph of a New York Times story on the 20th. This weekend, singer-songwriter Leonard Cohen is celebrating his 80th birthday with a cigarette. Last year, he announced that he would resume smoking when he turned 80. The quote is, it's the right age to recommence. And the larger theme here, which I have to say I haven't thought much about at all, but I'm going to start thinking about now, is in this society, we essentially live for the future. We invest in our future selves, I would argue, to the detriment of joy in our present life. And so for starters, is that not a dilemma that people in your profession should be talking about and should also be talking to doctors to talk to their patients about?
It is. First, let me point out that you haven't thought about this, Jim, because you don't have enough lithium in your water. But in a lithium-rich environment. So,
okay.
I may surprise you on this one. I do think about it, and I actually happen to agree with Leonard Cohen. And I'll give you another example, a parallel one to this. We had a big fight, the VA hospital here. There were vets well into their 80s who wanted to continue to smoke, and we were pushing stop smoking campaigns on them. And they would go outside in the cold and huddle up in their little hut and smoke. And I finally said, you know, what are we doing here? They're 80, 82, 84. They want to smoke. I admit smoking isn't good for you, but I'm not sure they have lots of enjoyment, lots of things to do. And anyway, really, you know, how much life are we going to lose at this point in time? So I do think about it a lot. And I'm not sure I would agree that Americans forego a lot of pleasures if we looked at the you know, lifestyles we lead, there's a lot of fun and games that aren't sort of on the health side of the ledger. But when you get older and people start to say, boy, you know, you better not have that second beer or you better not enjoy that second scoop of ice cream or something. You start getting into these health fads in the nursing homes. I don't buy that at all.
Okay, well, fine. I got you. So, but I want to take it. I meant it much more broadly than the 80-year-olds of the world, the Leonard Cohens of the world. I mean the 25-year-olds who go to the gym 2 hours a day and the thought that they would ever – I mean this sincerely – ever allow the joy of a cheeseburger to touch their lips is absurd. I'm saying to myself, I want my doctor to say to me, it's great, Jim or Marjorie, that you're getting fit. However, it's also important for the quality of your life that you have a little more joy in your life. You can occasionally slip. You can have that cone. Don't wait till you're 80. I'm not, smoking's a bad example because obviously it affects other people too. But isn't that true all around? We're so concerned about how long.
I got another story for you.
Well, go ahead.
Which one of you is a jogger, Marjorie?
I used to run for years.
Yeah. So here's the deal. I found this out from a physiologist. I believe it to be true, but if you listeners think it's wrong, just write to Marjorie.
Don't okay.
bother me. But he said for every 2 minutes you jog, you probably add about a minute of life to your life. So that's fine. But if it really then makes sense to jog, if you like jogging. Because if you don't like jogging,
you're losing
exactly.
a minute.
Losing time.
That is
exactly.
But that's a 10 times better example. So should a doctor, when I'm 27 years old, sitting across from him or her, say to Marjorie or me or you, Art, it's great you're jogging, but let me tell you what the facts are before you decide to spend so much of your life doing this. They should be telling you that, shouldn't they?
Absolutely. And there's another group that believes in strict calorie restriction to extend your life. You know, these people are sort of 130 pounds, not quite anorexic, but they're really dieting to the extreme. And I keep thinking, you know, the good news is you're going to live a long time. And that's probably the bad news, too. It's like finding out if I go on a certain regimen, I could live much longer. And then I also find out that I get to go to faculty meetings much more. So, yeah, I think there are trade-offs there. I really do. And I think you have to think about them. And, to be serious about this, I think that old Aristotelian maxim, which I know every listener knows, moderation in all things,
yes.
excess in none, isn't bad advice. So, yeah, you can sin a little bit or eat a potato chip once in a while. I think you got to sort of keep with the good health habits, but yeah, I agree. You know, there's room in life for a little fun and a little goofiness.
By the way, the middle ground is when you don't feel like eating a potato chip, Marjorie knows, I just rub a potato chip all over my arms and legs just to get
last
the feel,
night,
you know?
I went out with a friend of mine. I had a big, fat, juicy cheeseburger.
Did you really?
With loads of French fries and bacon on the side. It was just terrific.
I was at the gym last night. Hey, before you go, what's on the podcast this week, Everyday Ethics, Art Kaplan?
So I think this week we're going to spend a little time talking about the ethical challenges raised by Ebola, because what we're seeing is probably some of the hardest questions ever, trying experimental drugs, experimental vaccines, when you really haven't tested them much more than in a few animals, you're going to throw them into the battle and take the chances that you might actually wind up either hurting people or doing more harm than good. Pretty tough choices out there right now in West Africa.
Art Kaplan, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. Art Kaplan is the head of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center and also the co-host of Everyday Ethics. You just heard him talk about it. It's a podcast. Thanks, Art.
Thanks, Art.
So I'm going to tell you what we're going to do in a second, but I just want to give credit to Tom from Lowell. He reminded us when we were talking about Charlie Baker calling a reporter sweetheart that Barack Obama called a reporter sweetie
in Detroit
back in 2008,
yes,
and he was elected president, so we'll see how this plays out in the Baker Coakley race.
Tom.
Anyway, up next, we're going to ask you, is Leonard Cohen, just talking about him with Art Kaplan, onto something by reigniting his relationship with cigarettes? At a certain point, does it make more sense to enjoy the here and now rather than investing in your future self? That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.